Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, a weekly mix of science interviews and great music. I'm Jorge Salazar. Let's begin with this scientist soundbite.
I'd say first and foremost, we want to understand how is it that these very aged tissues retain this capacity to almost completely rejuvenate themselves.
You're listening to Robert DePigno at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. He led a promising scientific study that, in a sense, turned back the clock on mice and reversed signs of their aging. Dr. DePigno engineered mice with a gene that can be switched on and off to control an enzyme called telomerase. Telomerase builds telomeres, a kind of cap that protects the end of chromosomes, the stuff in cells that pass on genetic traits. Telomerase was switched off and the mice prematurely aged. It was later switched on and they reverted back to their younger selves. Dr. DePigno is on the line now to explain his findings. Welcome to the program, Dr. DePigno.
Pleasure to be here.
Now tell us about the main results of your study that looked at a way to reverse the aging process of mice.
Well, the most important lesson that we learned from this study is that aged tissues, even when ones in an advanced state of degeneration, retain a remarkable capacity to renew themselves. Essentially, what we did in this study was to engineer mice with an inducible telomerase gene. Telomerase is a special enzyme that helps to maintain the tips of our chromosomes, so-called telomeres. As we age, we incur damage at the telomeres. We accumulate damage as well as the telomeres become eroded. And over the course of time, that signals to the cell to enter an aged state. And essentially, by being able to regulate the enzyme that can restore those telomeres, we're in a position to ask what happens when we toggle this gene on and off. In the off state, these animals aged prematurely. They had shrunken brains, impaired myelination, which is very typical of that which occurs in human brains. That is the sheaths that surround the neurons, so the neurons don't work as well. They have impaired cognition, decreased stem cells throughout their body in a variety of different organ systems. So we see organ atrophy, gray hair, dermatitis, and these mice were infertile. So in this state of severe degeneration, which I would peg the equivalent to be in somebody in their eighth or ninth decade of life, we turned the gene back on. And we found that that repaired the telomeres. And we were expecting perhaps a slowing or a stabilization of the aging process. And instead, we witnessed a dramatic reversal in the signs and symptoms of aging. So the brains increased in size, cognition improved, the coat hair was restored to a healthy sheen, and fertility was restored. So this teaches us that there's a point of return for these tissues if you remove the underlying cause, which in this case was excessive DNA damage at the tips of our chromosomes.
That was Robert DePigno at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'll be right back. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science, heard globally on 1,200 stations around the world, including Voice of America. Beth Lebwohl is here to share an interview with a journalist who spent time writing a new book on polar bears. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
So tell us, what's going on with polar bears?
Well, I interviewed Kieran Mulvaney, who's author of the new book, The Great White Bear, which was published in the spring of 2011. And he had lived in Alaska for about 7 years and had really, I would say, fallen under the spell of polar bears. He had immense respect for them. He loved them. He cherished them. And this book is really, I found to be a celebration of them.
They're very smart. They're very patient. It's very hard not to anthropomorphize polar bears when you watch them in the wild. The first time we saw a good, healthy polar bear off the Russian Arctic, it seemed to be swaggering, you know. Its shoulders were rolling like it was, you know, a prize fighter. And as the crew, one of the crew on the icebreaker said to me as we watched, he goes, "Yeah, look at him. He owns the ice." They have an air about them of that really is unique to these, you know, top of the food chain carnivores.
But then he explained to me that polar bears are creatures of paradox. You know, they're so well adapted to the Arctic environment in which they live that their challenge is not actually staying warm, it's keeping cool. And I asked him about that.
Polar bears have basically many different ways of doing everything that they can to, you know, to stay warm. They have the fur is, for one thing, the hairs in their coat are hollow, and that allows them to trap air within each hair, and also within, you know, between the different hairs. So that's a nice little blanket of air right there. They have black skin, which, and as we know, black sort of attracts sunlight and causes them to heat up even more, and they have this great thick layer of blubber as well. Their ears are smaller than other bears, and that allows less heat to evaporate. They're so well insulated that you'll notice, you know, in the same way that you know that your roof, your attic needs insulating, you know, if all the snow disappears off it when it stays on your neighbors. The snow, when polar bears get covered in snow, the snow stays there. They're so well insulated, heat isn't escaping. And so they very easily overheat. And you often see them, you know, rolling around in the snow, resting in the snow. You know, you'll sometimes see, particularly early in the season, as the ice is starting to form for the first time, you'll see them just sit down on the ice or flatten themselves out on the ice or even punch a hole through the ice and just sit so that their butts are in the cold water underneath. So they're so incredibly well adapted. They're capable of great bursts of speed to catch seals, but then afterwards they have to kind of pant and recover and gather their energy. And that's, you know, one reason why, you know, they're so well adapted to the Arctic. As it gets warmer, it's one of the things that they suffer with, of course.
And what he's referring there to, of course, is the warming of the Arctic. Ice is expected to be completely melted in the summer times in the Arctic by about, I believe it's either mid-century or the end of the century. So polar bear's future is really in question. But that's, you know, sort of the bad news. But the rest of the interview, I asked him about his favorite things about polar bears, and he mentioned their patience, intelligence, and also their quiet.
First thing that I really noticed about polar bears is they are quiet. I've only ever once heard a polar bear vocalize in the wild. They have a kind of hiss when they're frightened, a little bit like a cat hiss. You know, it has that same kind of guttural sort of element to it. But generally, they're very, very quiet. They not only don't vocalize, but their paws are massive. They're like snowshoes. And I've watched the polar bear come toward me and pad toward me and closer and closer and closer over snow. And it was only when it was about, you know, 10 or 12 feet away, I mean, I was safely up on a viewing platform looking down at it, that I heard the very, very, very softest of crunches of snow underneath as it carried on. And, of course, that helps them be very, very good predators. Another thing that's
remarkable about polar bears, and I mentioned this earlier, is they're very, very intelligent. They have shown a tremendous ability to understand what's going on. That helps them, obviously, hunt down seals. One person I was speaking to, you know, said he used to, from a viewing platform, kind of lower down his camera on a pole, and they would take photographs of polar bears' face because each of their whiskers is different. You can use polar bear whiskers to kind of identify them individually. And after a couple of times, this flash went off on the camera, and you could tell the polar bear didn't like that. And he just, ever so quietly, just put one of his claws on the lip of the camera lens. Didn't destroy the camera, just put it there so that, you know, the guy couldn't actually move the camera anymore. And the polar bear just kind of looked up at the photographer, and the photographer looked back and sort of said, sorry, I won't do that again. And the polar bear just quietly let it go. I mean, they do seem to display a tremendous intelligence. And related to that, I think one of the other third things that's very interesting is they are very, very patient. Obviously, the Arctic is a very difficult environment. You can't afford to waste your energy. They will take a long time to just sit and wait and watch the patterns of their potential prey, sit and wait by holes in the ice where seals may or may not be coming through. They are prepared to wait for a very long period. And so sometimes they'll wait for hours for a seal to pop up through a hole in the ice, and then they'll try and swipe it. And natives in particular have said that, you know, they spend so much time waiting that occasionally when they miss the seal after all that effort, you'll see a polar bear swat the ice or swat the snow in frustration with their paws until they decide to get back down to work and listen again and wait again.
That would be scary to be so close to a polar bear. That was a great story about being up close to a polar bear.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Well, thanks, Beth, for your story.
Hey, thank you, Jorge. And I think that the note I want to end on is that these creatures really do sound magnificent, and it is true that their fate is in question because their environment is changing, and it's scientists don't know exactly how they will be able to cope at this time.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl and her interview with journalist Kieran Mulvaney on his new book, The Great White Bear, Natural and Unnatural History of Polar Bears. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky. Deborah Bird joined us now in the studio to talk about the global night sky. Welcome back, Deborah.
Oh, thanks, Jorge. I'm glad to be here.
What do you have for us today?
Well, Jorge, today I want to teach you how to have an experience of being inside our Milky Way galaxy, traveling around the center of the galaxy. Our Milky Way galaxy, as you know, is a collection of several hundred billion stars. It's 100,000 light years across.
Billions and billions big.
Yeah, that's right. And our sun is about two-thirds of the way out from the center of the galaxy. Our sun and Earth and all the other planets of our solar system move around the galaxy's center, and there are various estimates for the speed the sun travels through space, but the sun's speed is about 140 miles per second.
That's fast.
Yes, it is. So it just so happens that astronomers know which star the sun is moving toward in our journey around the galaxy. And in January, this star appears both in the west-northwest at dusk and nightfall, and it also appears in the east-northeast at and before dawn. This star is called Vega, and it's in the constellation Lyra the Harp. It's a very bright, bluish star that you can see very easily northwest in the evening, northeast before dawn. And by the way, our sun's direction of motion toward this star, Vega, and so our Earth's corresponding motion as well, has a special name. It's called the apex of the sun's way.
So if I look in the direction of the star Vega this month, I'm looking in the direction the sun is moving around the galaxy center?
That's right. Northwest in the evening, northeast before dawn. And as I said, we're moving 140 miles per second. Moving at that speed, it takes the sun about 230 million years to complete one circuit of the galaxy. And that period of time is known to astronomers as one cosmic year.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org.
The one piece of the puzzle that I think we do understand well is that as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water, and thus the water in the atmosphere increases with warming.
You're listening to Frank Wentz, Director of Remote Sensing Systems in Santa Rosa, California. Predicting when it'll rain just got a whole lot trickier, said Wentz, because of human-caused global warming from CO2 emissions. Dr. Wentz uses satellites to measure changes in the water high above in Earth's atmosphere, not just from rain and clouds, but the invisible water vapor that makes up 99% of the water in our atmosphere. Here to tell us more about how global warming affects rainfall is Frank Wentz. Welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here.
Now, what are the most important elements that go into studying the connection of greenhouse gases that warm the planet and changes to rainfall patterns? And in other words, in answering the question of your study of how much more rain will global warming bring?
Well, as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water, and thus the water in the atmosphere increases with warming. Now, the more difficult question is how much of this additional water is going to turn into rain. Just because there's more water in the atmosphere doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be that much more rain. The rainfall is also determined by the air circulation. It's sort of like a conveyor belt. And even though the packets on the conveyor belt contain more water, if the conveyor belt slows down, then there'll be less rain.
And this this time series that you referred to, you're talking about measurements made by satellites, right?
That's right. AQUA flies a microwave radiometer called AMSR-E. And the way this radiometer works is it actually listens to the natural emission of microwaves from the Earth. And by measuring these microwaves, you can very accurately measure water vapor in the atmosphere. And I didn't say it, but almost all the water in the atmosphere, 99% of the water in the atmosphere, is water vapor. It's invisible. You don't see it when you look up at the sky. You look up the sky, you see clouds and rain. But the clouds and rain are only about 1% of the total water. Almost all the water is in terms of this vapor. And the microwaves can measure the vapor very, very well, very precisely. We use about 10 different satellites, and we piece them all together starting back in the 1980s until today to generate these 25 and 30-year time series of water vapor and rainfall.
How do the measurements by AQUA fit into the larger picture of studying the effects of global warming on precipitation?
Actually, surprisingly, as it turns out, the measurement of water is more accurate than direct measurements of temperature. It's what engineers call a signal-to-noise ratio. And the signal-to-noise ratio for the water measurement is about 7 times higher than the signal-to-noise ratio of the direct temperature measurement that other satellites measure. So we're able to get a more accurate measure of global warming by using the microwave instruments that are on AQUA and also on other satellites. But the measurement of water was one of the first indications that the atmosphere was indeed warming at a fairly hefty rate, as the theory predicts. And that theory is called Clausius-Clapeyron, and it's basically warm air holds more water, and every degree the air increases, it can hold 7% more water.
You've written that that the changes in rainfall across the globe may be one of the most serious risks from climate change. Tell us more about what you meant by that.
Well, yeah, I think it's sort of obvious. I mean, you have world food production, and our world food production, you know, depends critically on rainfall. And we need to know where it will rain and how much rain there is going to be. And if these rain patterns begin to change and intensify, then we need to adapt quickly. We need to adapt our agriculture and crop selections and to match with the new rain patterns. And also there's some very heavily populated regions on the planet, such as Bangladesh, that are already plagued with flooding. And just the knowledge that we can expect a change should help us in planning. We sort of have to plan to be adaptive and be ready to, change agricultural plans as we see these things play out.
You've been listening to satellite researcher Frank Wentz. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Maneja Beto, 100 Flowers, and the Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art.